Hi, I'm Dr. Pam Peek, and welcome to episode 169 of Her, the podcast where you'll hear the naked truth about her mind, her body, her life, and today, her age. It's going to be a good one. We have a terrific show coming up. And before we begin, just know that this episode is made possible by our wonderful friends at Smarty Pants Women's Vitamins, the delicious once-a-day gummies that contain all of the essential vitamins, minerals, and omega oils customized just for women. To learn more, hop on over to SmartyPantsVitamins.com. And here's your reminder to click on to iTunes after this episode to rate and review the show. We look forward to hearing from you. Love it. Want to hear your feedback, and wait till you hear this episode. This is going to be a mind blower, so you'll have plenty to say on your rate and review. All right, it's time for Her.
Her, the podcast.
The naked truth about women.
Her mind, her body, her life. It's all about her.
Well, you know, I've been looking at this whole issue of aging now, since I'm doing the same thing. Whoops, I started doing that when I was a fetus. But look, we're all aging. But how do women view aging? How does anyone view aging? This is a really interesting topic, especially if you've hit the big 5-0, let alone 6-0, etc. And I don't care how old you are out there in her listening land, everyone needs to start examining whether or not they really are living a world of ageism. Are you doing that? Do you even know what that is? Well, we have probably the national expert on this entire topic, and that is Ashton Applewhite. I've had the pleasure of talking to Ashton. I've read her amazing book, This Chair Rocks, A Manifesto Against Ageism. I first got wind of her looking at her TEDx talk. It was amazing. In 11 minutes, she slammed it. It's amazing how you can really capture incredible, mind-blowing thoughts in just 11 minutes, but somehow Ashton pulled it off. I love it. And in addition, she's an internationally recognized expert on aging and ageism. Has spoken with and worked with United Nations, Harper's, Playboy, the New York Times. She is an author. And I can tell you right now, her writing is superb. And her narration, which she does for her book, which I've listened to in its totality, Walking My Wonderful German Shepherds, is superb. Again, she is articulate and an incredible leading spokesperson for the emerging movement to mobilize against discrimination on the basis of age. Hey, Ashton, welcome to the Her podcast.
Hey, Pam. Thank you. What a lovely introduction.
Yeah, I'm exhausted. Just a moment. I need a towel for my forehead or something. I don't know.
You're tired.
All right. So let's hop to this. You know, you say you want to reframe the way American culture sees age and aging. I mean, what got you started on this whole thing?
What got me started was getting older, and hindsight being 2020, because I never figure out anything until it's in the rearview mirror. I started this project about 12 years ago when I was 55, and you know, was afraid of getting older, pretty trepidatious about it. So, being a bull by the horns kind of girl, I started looking into longevity, researching it. And what knocked my socks off in about 30 seconds was how many of the things I thought I knew about growing older were way off base or way too black and white or flat out wrong. Just to name one, I just assumed that, of course, older people were depressed because it sucked to be old and they were, you know, closer to dying, and that must all be pretty terrible. And if you Google U-curve of happiness, because I had to, because I didn't believe it the first time I heard it, study after study everywhere in the world shows that people are happiest at the beginnings and the ends of their lives. And that's despite many of us living in cultures that tell us that nothing about aging is good. Lots about aging is difficult, but I am in the business of making sure we start to hear both sides of the story.
I mean, I really hear you. When I was watching your TED Talk, you just rattled off. I can't tell you how many stereotypic myths that are banging around out there.
Yeah.
The fact that the mass majority of people...
And I found those in the first, in my first 3 days of research. And I was like,
That's crazy.
Light bulb that went off was, why don't we know these things? And we don't know them because an ageist culture drowns them out in order to frame aging as a problem or a disease, because then we can be persuaded to buy things to fix it or cure it, big air quotes around those. And aging is not a problem, and it's not a disease. It is a natural, powerful, lifelong process that starts in as fetuses, as I love you pointed out. You know, it's not just something inconvenient that baby boomers do or, you know, athletes do. It's something that you, and it should unite us all, because it is the one universal human experience.
You know, something just hit me when you said that thing about, no, it's not a disease, et cetera. I don't know if I ever told you this, Ashton, but when I was in medical school, somewhat when the dinosaurs ruled the earth, maybe a little bit after that, there was a classic. I'm playing with you. I'm messing with you. But seriously, the reason why I said that about the, you know, the whole date thing is the textbook that was used at the time, looking at internal medicine and sort of just medicine per se, had pregnancy listed as a pathologic state. It was almost listed as a disease state. It was like someone who was editing the textbook didn't catch it. And I mean, you know, my jaw hit the floor.
Did men write these books by any chance? Were they written by any wild guess?
Wait a minute. I can guarantee you the answer was yes. Seriously, I read that, and then I called up about 20 of my, you know, my fellow student colleagues saying, am I reading this wrong? Am I missing something here? And they said, holy moly. And so we wrote to the editors. You'll be proud, Ashton. We were little activists.
Good, I am
we wrote
proud.
To the editors saying, hi, if pregnancy is a pathologic state, then that means that whatever happens, the products of pregnancy must be pathological too. Is that correct? And, you know,
as
and
I
we
say,
got back
you know,
to
if,
fat.
If aging, yeah. if aging is a disease, then living is a disease.
Yeah. Well, that's where I was going with this whole thing. Needless to say, the next edition of this textbook was very, very fixed and corrected.
That's wonderful.
But
I mean,
I still,
we used to,
you know,
I mean, most of what we know about older people used to come from studying the very old and infirm in nursing homes. And then the field of gerontology emerged. We began to live longer, and we came to understand that many of the changes that we had sort of assumed were age-related were, in fact, could easily be addressed by medication or change in diet or change in lifestyle. And we're not confined. You know, they're of course, there are two inevitable bad things about aging. People you've known all your life are going to die, and some part of your body is going to deteriorate, but not everything and not all at once. And the longer we live, the more different from one another we become, the less you can extrapolate from someone's chronological age, what they're capable of, what they're interested in, what their physical and cognitive function is.
Oh, you got that down. I mean, there's no question about it. You know, it's interesting. As a physician who does a lot of work in lifestyle medicine, one of the topics that keeps coming up all the time, Ashton, is the issue of, and I quote, anti-aging therapies. Anti-aging. So we're back to that again. What are we anti-ing about when it's a natural process, like an anti-pregnancy therapy? What are we doing here? So I like the fact that you kind of shifted the conversation from anti-aging, which is, you know, bizarre, to anti-ageism instead.
Right.
So tell us about that.
Well, the definition of ageism is discrimination on stereotyping on the basis of age. we are being ageist, and we are all ageist. We are, I think and do ageist stuff all the time, and it's my field. We are ageist anytime we make an assumption about a person or a group of people based on how old we think they are. You know, and these, the, where you see most of the anti-aging stuff is, of course, in the healthcare field, and in particularly in cosmetics, which relates to women, because there is this pernicious, damaging double standard around aging, which is that men are enhanced by aging. You know, think of all the silver foxes on television, whereas if a woman, God forbid, lets her hair go gray, no one's going to want to look at her, you know, on TV or anywhere else. And that double standard is deeply unfair. But fear and shame create markets, right? And as long as we women are caught up in this idea that to age is to fail, we get sucked into this destructive and competitive way of thinking. I mean, if you think about it, we know that it's really important to change and adapt and grow and develop through life. And then, especially for women, but also for men, somewhere north of middle age, wherever middle age is these days, the ideal suddenly becomes to stop the clock. And success, in quotes, starts to be defined in the degree to which you can keep looking and moving like a younger version of yourself. This is not possible. It's futile. It's expensive. It's huge, has a huge class bias because not, you know, there are also a lot of people cannot afford the time or the access to, you know, gyms and sushi that make it possible, and vacations, hello, leisure time, that make it possible. And most of all, it fills us with fear and it divides us. And where we women see this particularly is in this competition to look and stay young. Every time we walk in a room and berate the other people in it by age, especially the other women, and we all do this, no blame, no shame, I swear. But think what we are doing. We are reinforcing the idea that what's most important about us is how we look, right? We are reinforcing the idea that we need to be, you know, attractive in conventional norms dictated by patriarchy and sexism and ageism. And these are not our friends, right? And when we do that, we dig the hole deeper. So we women, I know this is a radical ask, but I know it's important and it sure makes you feel better, is to find new ways of coming together at all ages to talk about this stuff so we can quit this foolish competition game and start, you know, developing ways of working together against sexism and ageism that enable us to be our full, powerful selves all life long and not deny our age, but embrace it.
Yeah, that's why one of the reasons why you were so upset with this issue of, and I quote, successful aging. I think that that was defined certainly by the media as still looking like you're 20 years younger. And so you've successfully navigated wrinkles and whatever else, gray hair and back and forth, so that you can sort of almost hold time still. And just say, well, you know, here I am. Don't I look just
wonderful?
The term
came out of a MacArthur study. It's come out. There's a ton of really well-intentioned people in the positive aging movement that use the term. And I am, let's be frank, I am at one end of a spectrum. But what, and I should mention, I've written about all these things on my blog, thischairrocks.com/blog. So if you want to learn more about them, the information is all there, easily accessible and it's searchable. The problem with successful aging is the stuff I already ran through, that it's very, you know, class prejudiced, right? Because it's expensive, these remedies. And also there's this idea that the underlying thing is aging successfully really means not aging, right? It means succeeding in looking and moving like younger people. Then suppose you're aging successfully and a friend of yours develops a chronic condition or starts to lose ground cognitively. What do you do with that friendship? You know, we need to embrace and acknowledge the fact, for one thing, as a physician, I know this is important to you, that aging well, aging healthfully, can and often does include disability. People with disabilities are not sick, and they do not, you know, crawl into holes and lead lives of misery. They lead lives that are as full of meaning if they have the opportunity and the support that everyone else does. So we need to look deeply at these things, because once you look, it's a lot less scary, and destigmatize them and see that we're all in this journey at different rates together, and that there's no division between young and old, independent and dependent. We're all interdependent, ugly and beautiful. You know, all these binaries do us no favors.
Well, you know, I always say that if by the age of 50, certainly, you don't have knees or other joints that do a little snap, crackle, and pop, you haven't lived. And that as a physician, you know, it's interesting, Ashton, I'm not sure you know this. This is really quite fascinating. They have a number of studies around that are really quite novel. There's one that's being run out of the University of California, San Diego, and it's a study of the, get this, welderly. Now, to be someone who is, I know, I love it. There is the definition of welderly for this study is you must be 85 or older. So that means Justice Ginsburg can be part of this. And in this, except for this one little issue, and that is you really can't have any chronic illness. And guess what they do not call a chronic illness? They don't call arthritis a chronic illness. In other words, osteoarthritis, the snap, crackle, and pop of, you know, because it's normal. It's like looking at a great car you've had for a while, and obviously it's going to have some interesting noises every now and then. Well, yeah, it's X number of years old, and that's what happens. And so it's seen as a very natural thing. I thought that was fascinating that they just sort of said, we don't see that as disease or anything. You're just older. You have a little snap, crackle, and pop, and that's the way it goes. And the grand majority of older people work around that. They say, well, yeah, of course. I mean, I'm fill in the blank. I'm 73. I'm 78. And of course I'm going. It's one of those, of course I'm going to have these issues. And when you actually interview centenarians, the grand majority of whom are women, they're very matter of fact. Well, of course I need my cane. Of course I'm going to be walking down the stairs slowly. Sort of like, what's wrong with you? You're an idiot. If you don't think that that's not going to happen to you too. And there's this sort of like,
there's no shame in it.
No. And there's no, you know, I'm suffering from a disease. You know, if you have to go a little, if you have to walk a little slower, and if maybe your balance isn't the world's greatest like it used to be and all the rest of it, yeah, well, welcome to being over the age of 50, honey. You know, that's the way it is.
Right.
And that's normal.
Right, it is.
It's completely normal, right?
It's normal. And I mean, but I would say osteoarthritis is clearly a disease of aging, as is Alzheimer's, as is Parkinson's. But there are a lot of other diseases that we associate with aging because they become symptomatic later in life, but they're associated with lifestyle decisions and diet and stuff, patterns that start much younger. So, I mean, my guess is they didn't include arthritis because they wouldn't have had anyone left in their sample group.
Exactly.
You know, I'd love to make a point about health and aging because it relates to ageism in a way that is, again, something that totally surprised me when I started learning about this. More and more studies show that attitudes towards aging affect how our minds and bodies function at the cellular level. You know, we've learned a lot about the mind-body connection, but we now know that people who associate aging with becoming useless or decrepit or invisible, they walk more slowly, they don't heal as fast, they die sooner, and they have less good cognitive function. The latest study compared a group of 5,000 older people for 5 years, people with more positive attitudes towards aging developed less dementia, even if they had the gene that predisposed them towards the disease. Isn't that fascinating?
Well, you know what it is it's the power of belief. You know, we've been studying this go ahead.
Right. And also it's you know, stress is the negative here. Broadly defined, and the fact of dealing with an ageist culture and having to push back against these negative messages and having that inner voice, saying, oh, it's all going to go to hell, 90 hertz, so next I'm not going to be able to roll out of bed. all those things generate stress, and that stress is bad for you. If you can see that much of those messages are not true.
Yeah. Well, stress is toxic to the aging process.
Exactly. And an ageist culture stresses, you know, produces all kinds of economic stress, discrimination in the workforce, health stress. It's hard. There's tremendous ageism in healthcare as well as sexism. You know, doctors write off, you know, conditions of, at your age, what do you expect? You know, the classic line, I use it in my TED talk, you know, my other knee is just as old and it doesn't hurt. So how can it be my age? And we ourselves are a huge part of the problem because we have internalized these negative messages, most of us, and never thought to question them. So we tend to blame things on age that are not necessarily age-related. And whether they are or not are often highly treatable. Depression, for example, older people enjoy better mental health than young or middle-aged people because we're better at dealing with negative emotions. We have more equanimity. We're better at taking the long view. But depression in older people goes treated less often because people think, oh, she's old, of course she's depressed, and also underestimate the ability of older people to respond to talk therapy and pharmacology, which, of course, we do.
You know, what I hear from a lot of people of all ages is that the older population will, as you said in your book, the older population bogs everyone else down in caring for the sick and the frail, and that society will be swamped by all these old people. Please set the record straight, Ashton.
The metaphor I really hate is this gray tsunami, which you hear a lot of, you know, all these incapacitated old people like swamping the shore and sucking all the good stuff out to sea and leaving nothing for the young. First of all, it's not a tsunami. Population aging is the best studied demographic phenomenon in history. We've known it's coming. We know all about it. Why haven't we done more to prepare for it? Hello, ageism. But healthcare costs are not rising in proportion to the age of the population. And there's tons of data on my website and in my book. I won't bore you with statistics. Healthcare costs are the highest at the end of life, but that's true whether you die at 18 or you die at 80. And it's often because of high cost interventions. And those interventions are profitable and often legally mandated. It is technology that is driving the increase in healthcare costs. And it's why U.S. healthcare is more expensive than healthcare elsewhere around the world. That's not a too many old people problem.
Huh. All right. So that whole issue of the older population will bog everyone down, that olders are a drag on the economy, and that they're just
a bunch of doddering, sick, and frail people.
Hmm?
There's no truth to the fact that older people are a drag on the economy. First of all, older people are staying in the job market longer. Second of all, if we retire, we continue to consume. There's a lot of wealth in the older population, although also a lot of poverty. So we continue to consume goods and services that employ younger people and keep businesses going and boost the GDP. And also all these activities, you know, volunteer activities that older people engage in. They don't tend to be considered in economic terms, but they have not only obvious human and social value, they have economic value because they're performing a service that otherwise someone else would have to pay for, like looking in on a neighbor. If I watch my grandchild so my daughter can go to work, I am helping him stay in the workforce. So the whole picture of the economic contribution that older people make is much more nuanced, and it is absolutely flat out not true that older people are a drag on the economy.
Well, you know, I just love your numbers. I'm sorry. You said you didn't want to do numbers. I'll do them for you because they're right out of your book.
Please do.
So when you say olders are a drag on the economy, people 50 and up fuel the significant, fast-growing, and often overlooked longevity economy. According to AARP, which I love that title because no one's retired anymore, but oh well, they're going to have to work on that one. Spending by the 50-plus population amounted to $5.6 trillion in 2015. Now, you know, we're 3 years later, so you know it's higher. factor in the effects of this direct spending as it circulates through the economy, and the contribution to GDP amounted to $7.6 trillion. Overall, this spending supported more than 89.4 million jobs in 2015. That is 61% of all U.S. jobs. Now, here's the final coup de grace. By 2032, and honey, listen, it's coming. By 2032, the 50-plus age group is projected to drive more than half of U.S. Economic activity as their spending fuels industries that include apparel, healthcare, education, leisure, and entertainment. Whoa, I remember reading that paragraph, on my little Kindle here, and I hit that little ribbon up there saying, we're going to hold on to that page. And that just blew me away. No, but those numbers are amazing.
And the data is not, these are not arcane figures that I had to hire researchers to find. They're right there on the internet in 5 minutes.
And this whole issue of, it's interesting. You make a point. You said, we can't afford longevity. We can if we want to. And then tell us what you meant by that. What do you mean by
that?
Well,
it relates to what you just said. There's that a lot of macroeconomic thinking, portrays an aging population as a massive curb on economic activity. But the fact is that worldwide GDPs have been increasing along with lifespans for over a century. In anxious times, we look for scapegoats, and population aging is a handy one because older people don't have that much voice and agency to push back, and because the culture has brainwashed us, and also because it's not all ageism. Population aging is a relatively new phenomenon. I mean, and it has been a remarkable achievement. I mean, if you think, longer lives are a fundamental hallmark of human progress, but it is new. And the roles and institutions to accommodate this new longevity, to help older people stay in the workforce longer, for example, and stay healthier, and then to transition out gradually, which is obviously what makes sense. Obviously, this old idea that first you went to school, and then you worked, and then you retired in sort of tidy thirds, is completely obsolete. It takes time for roles and institutions to adapt. Sociologists call that structural lag. Where I get up on my really, really teeteringly high soapbox is to say that the roles and institutions that we adopt are going to be very different if we see longevity as the incredible opportunity that it represents, millions and millions of more healthy, educated, older people than ever before in human history, than as a catastrophe. It does present genuine challenges. Again, I'm not a Pollyanna about this. There are real medical and social and infrastructure challenges we need to meet, but we need to do it from a balanced perspective that doesn't consign older people to this sort of scrap heap of invisibility and uselessness. I mean, I don't know about you. I'm 66. I don't feel invisible or useless, and I don't want to be treated that way.
That's interesting, because you address that, Ashton, in chapter 2 of your book, This Chair Rocks, A Manifesto Against Ageism. It's called Our Ages, Ourselves, Identity. And it's this whole thing. You said, when I started this project, I'm quoting from what you wrote in the book, how old do you feel didn't seem like a loaded question. But then, the widespread tendency to knock a few years off your age seemed optimistic at best and harmless at worst. And then it started getting funkier. What do you mean what did you mean by this whole thing? Because, you went into this thing, feeling good equals feeling young and feeling bad equals feeling old. What does that mean?
Well, No one adds years to their age. No one says I'm older than I am, right? So every time we lie or fudge about our age, we are reinforcing the idea that younger equals better. And one way we do this is with our language. I hear people say, I don't feel old all the time. Or someone said to me, you know, pretty recently, my grandmother's 92, but she's not old. You know, hello, she's old. The problem, you know, by any metric, she's getting up there. The problem is when we use old as a placeholder for insert negative attributes. What he probably meant was my mom is really old, but she's still got her marble. She's a wonderful mother or grandmother. She's in the world in an interesting way. She can still bake a mean pie or run a corporation, right? She's still a three-dimensional person who is important and valuable, right? And so we need to use those words instead of young. And if someone says I'm feeling old, what they probably mean is I feel tired, or I feel lonely, or I feel invisible. Well, let's use those words, and let's remember that we used to feel all those things when we were 13 too, right? That those are not problems that are age related or attributes that come, you know, are inevitably come in sync with any given stage of life.
Interesting. You know, I'm just, again, thinking about, you know, people like Justice Ginsburg, who's 85 and, you know, robustly talks about it and has no problem with that. If you've seen that documentary, which is really quite interesting.
I've RGB. Had her.
Yeah, I've actually had her trainer on the show because Justice Ginsburg is here in Washington along with her trainer. And she's just extremely matter of fact, which, of course, is a
right,
great thing if you're
right. Why on earth should we be ashamed of getting older? Just think about that basic fact. You know, it's absurd. And why should aging be something to succeed or fail at? We don't succeed or fail at childhood or adolescence. So all these false binaries, you know, we need to question them, because the minute you look at them, you don't need to be Einstein. You say, well, this makes no sense. I mean, you know, one of my examples is like even people who haven't begun to think about this, in any sort of political sense or in terms of their identity, no one actually, no matter how scared or apprehensive they are about getting older, actually wants to be any younger. Right, you don't get to just trade out the cartilage. If you actually have to get to move your game piece back on the board, no one wants to do it, because we all know, even if it's still just in our lizard brains and we haven't articulated it yet, that aging enriches us, that we are a process of all the things we've done and been, right? And we don't want to erase that, nor should we.
Well, you know, there's something that comes up in my mind as you're speaking, Ashton, and that is there are many platforms here. One platform is sort of the psychological, intellectual, wise person, experienced that you're really speaking about. People like Ginsburg and others who could sit back and say, you know, been there, done that. Let me kind of give you my take on it, given my X number of, you know, decades in the biz. And that's fantastic. I'm going to now speak as a physician. And what I'm seeing, and you and I have talked about this before, is a fear of death and a fear of the aging process that leads you to that. The fact that by the time you are, say, for instance, 60, 65, whatever, it's a very good chance that you're pretty much past the halfway point in your life. And now you're, as it were, in people's minds, the vision, you know, coming down the other side of the hill, right? And that as a physician, what I have noted is a tremendous fear on the part of friends, family, and people who are undergoing this issue of death and dying and perhaps living with a chronic illness that you know is going to be really robbing you, as it were, of a lot of your faculties, mm-hmm. no matter what, that people have fear. And here's the deal I have with this fear. There is a worse fear of discussing it, of throwing it on the table, confronting it, having an open, honest, transparent, authentic conversation about this entire topic. Sometimes you can't even get people to talk about what's in their will, or even do you have one?
Crazy. Or make a will.
Have you made any plans? Do you know what you want? How do we honor your wishes if you won't talk about it? And I'm sure there's some pretty interesting data and statistics out there about the number of people who won't do that and make their kids and grandkids nuts because they're trying to honor wishes that nobody wants to talk about. And so, you know, as a physician, what I see is a huge amount of fear here, a lot of fear, and nobody wants to talk about it.
You know, I often think of my work as paving the way, because if we don't want to acknowledge that we're aging, that's age denial. And age denial, by the way, is the heart of the problem. If we don't acknowledge that we're aging, we let all these stereotypes feed our worldview. If we don't acknowledge that we're aging, we're sure as heck not going to acknowledge that we are mortal. So it is all the same conversation. I think, and I'm glad you brought this up. I'm sure you know Atul Gawande's wonderful book, Being Mortal, and he talks about, you know, how if we want to have the death that we would like, it's of course essential to talk about what we want. Sometimes it's the ill person who doesn't want to talk about it. Sometimes it's the family and kids. There's a super useful resource called the Conversation Project, which has, it's a free download, and it has really really excellent conversation starters, no matter which side of the table you are on, that puts things in non-binary terms. One example I remember is not, you know, do you want them to pull the plug? Which is, first of all, a terrifying question. Second of all, our responses change as we move through life. This is an ongoing conversation. It's not just one you have once. And thirdly, you know, things change. I have a whole thing in my book about how the bull looks different. We don't know what it's going to be like till we get there. One example was, are you afraid of more medical intervention or less? Too little or too much? And it's a 0 to 5 slider, right? So you can, and you can change, you know, you can change that slider. As you point out, the minute we look at this stuff, it's funny, you know, I still think of myself as a 5-year-old, you know, jumping onto my bed from as far away as possible because I didn't want the monster under the bed to grab my ankle. There is a monster under the bed. We are going to get old. We're going to lose family and friends, and we are going to die. But it is a lot less scary once you look at it. I sat my kids down in the garden finally, you know, figure I should walk the walk. And two things happened. One is I went through, like, I don't want any, you know, major intervention. And my son said, well, what if you're hit by a bus today? And I'm like, I want that liver transplant. And he rolled his eyes and said, well, that would be a major intervention, right? What I want now is likely to be different from what I might want if I live to be 90 and I'm more debilitated. The other thing that happened was my daughter told me a few days later, she said, Emily, her partner, really didn't want to be part of that conversation. And once it was over, she felt so much better because we had looked under the bed. And when you name the dragon and see that there are ways of dealing with it and absolutely wonderful tools, you feel better because the fear of what we all know is the case is worse, 1,000 times worse than starting to figure out how to come to terms with it.
I love it. And those words are beyond wise. And I hope everyone out there in her podcast land heard that. You know, as we wind this up, I want you to define what age pride is.
I would say it is the opposite of age shame. The predominant culture wants us to feel ashamed of getting older because that way we will buy things to remedy it. And there is nothing unnatural or shameful about getting older. And when you look at the reasons behind the shame, you see that those cultural forces are not our friends. Aging is not something we can succeed or fail at. The problems we have as individuals, you know, we look in the mirror and go, oh my God, what happened? And I need to have a facelift or buy fancy face cream or put a bag over my head or whatever. First of all, you look beautiful. Second of all, that this is not a personal misfortune because it is a widely shared problem. Same with not being able to get a job. Oh, I need to learn, you know, lose 50 pounds or learn Excel or, you know, whatever. you are, yes, you need to keep your skills up to date, but what you are facing is a social problem that requires collective political action. That's why we need a movement like the women's movement to challenge and overturn these negative stereotypes about aging and to turn aging from a socially engineered source of shame to a source of collective, powerful identity and pride.
I love it. And I'm going to gift everyone with a few last words from your book, which is literally the few last words of your book, so that you can understand what a rich experience this book is. Age pride is for everyone who refuses to regret waking up a day older, who acknowledges long life as the privilege it is, and who is prepared to challenge the power structures that underlie all discrimination. We are all aging. Everyone benefits when we make common cause against oppression. Age pride is for everyone. Wow. I love it, Ashton. This book literally rocks. And talk about this chair rocks. This book rocks. I mean, seriously, this has been absolutely a fabulous episode, really looking at this whole issue of how we, especially as women, should view aging and then have a little look at ageism per se. Everyone out there in her podcast land, we have been talking to Ashton Applewhite. The title of her book is This Chair Rocks, A Manifesto Against Ageism. And if you want to learn more about the book and her work, just go to thischairrocks.com. And also, you have another voice here. Tell everyone very briefly what, yo, is this ageist? What is that?
You know, ageism is a new idea to a lot of people. And there is a fantastic Tumblr blog that's been around for a long time called Yo, Is This Racist? And he is hilarious, the person who writes it. And in frank imitation, which I cop to right up front, I started a blog called Yo, Is This Ageist? He started his blog because we're uncomfortable talking about race. I started this, and it's a Q&A blog. Ask me a question, and I'll tell you whether or not I think it's ageist and why. Because we honestly often don't know whether something is ageist or not. I mean, a good litmus test is, would the same comment, if it were relative to race or sex, pass muster? If not, it's probably ageist. But it's a place where you can say, look, someone said this thing to me. I saw this sign. Is it ageist or not? In order to educate ourselves about what it looks like and what we can do about it. And let me just say one thing.
I love it. Okay.
This is a podcast mainly for women. Women will lead this movement.
I love it. And, you know, now you have a lot of different ways to be able to reach out and get a little bit of Ashton Applewhite and learn all about her campaign to combat ageism in this society, because this is going to be an incredible experience. We all need to hop on board, because guess what? Aging is a natural process, and honey, y'all be doing it right now as we speak, or as I speak. So thank you, Ashton, for this eye-opening episode. And everyone, please make certain to get on over to her website, This Chair Rocks, to learn more. And now take a moment, hit iTunes, rate and review the show. We're here just waiting to hear your feedback. Love to be able to know how this affected you as well. Throw out your questions. We want to hear from you. Hey, I'm Dr. Pam Peek, host of the HER podcast. Follow me on Facebook at Dr. Pam Peek or Twitter at Pam Peek MD. And remember to catch every episode of the HER podcast on iTunes or Radio MD. Thanks for listening today, and stay well.